This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Our next speaker is Susan Meisner. Susan is a disability counsel from the ACLU here in San Francisco and is backed by popular demand to hear more about supported decision-making, civil liberties, and alternatives to conservatorship. So thank you to guardianship. Thank you so much for being here today, Susan. And you want to sit?
Yes.
Okay.
And this stool is my reasonable accommodation.
There you go.
Thank you to Jerry and Lucy for the invitation. It's really lovely to be here. How do I work this? I just go forward. Got it. Okay. Is someone else going to turn these for me? Yes. And will you move them forward for me, or do I?
So you just push this right here.
Okay.
Forward, reverse.
Okay. Okay. Great. Thank you. I'm in control. I like that.
Forward, reverse.
Thank you. Giving you your workout for the day. Okay. The thing that I take off of my bio is that I'm a graduate of Yale and Stanford, and this is exactly why. okay, so we're gonna cover the three main issues that we're covering today are the problems with conservatorships, the promise of supported decision making, and then going beyond the binary in trying to do competency evaluations. The first two, I'm hoping, are a bit of a review, and but I want to ask first, how many of you have worked with people under conservatorship? A lot. Okay. How many of you have done competency evaluations? A smaller number? All right. And then how many of you know what supported decision making is? Pretty good. And how many of you have practiced supported decision making in your practice? Okay, it's probably more of you than who raised your hands, but we'll go over that. All right. So let's talk about what conservatorship is first. It's a legal process, right? You have the court, you have an individual with a disability, and the court appoints someone else to be making decisions for that individual. The legal standard for doing that is that the individual is unable to provide for his or her personal needs, being able to provide food, clothing, shelter, even with supports, that's important, and also important, there are no less restrictive options available. I'm forgetting to do this. No. Okay. You're moving these for me, aren't you? Okay. The conservator controls essentially everything when it is a plenary conservatorship. So there are conservatorships that are supposed to be more restrictive, that they only control a certain part of someone's life. But even after decades of advocacy to improve the way we implement conservatorships, we find that that generally doesn't happen, that plenary conservatorships are the default mode for most judges. It's understandable. They're worried about what would happen if they don't provide enough protection. And there's a very paternalistic culture in conservatorship probate courts. But what this means is that the person who's under conservatorship essentially ceases to exist as a legal entity. The conservator takes away any possibility of decision-making legally. We've had situations in which the conservator not only controls the money and the living situation, but also whether or not to go to religious observances, whether the individual is able to see or refuse to see family members, and whether the individual is able to marry or make medical decisions. Next slide. I'm going to do it this time. Okay. From an ACLU perspective, we care about this because it is the most complete deprivation of civil liberties, aside from the death penalty, which Claude Pepper acknowledged in a congressional review of this issue years ago. But we have made fairly little progress since then. From a parent's perspective, civil liberties probably aren't that important. What's much more important is the way that the conservatorship will affect the child's life. And we've already gone through, Claude Pepper. We've already gone through the fact that the court appoints the conservator, but I should also point out that the court can remove the conservator. So we have had situations in which the court has appointed a parent because that was the sort of plan for the family, but then the parent is resisting what the court is ordering the parent to do and decides, okay, fine, I'm removing you as conservator, and I'm appointing a professional conservator. Professional conservators often don't have a lot of time to get to know the individual. They often go sort of by rote and often will default to institutional placements when other options aren't easy. The other piece is that for many of the population that we're most interested in, folks with developmental disabilities, decision-making can increase with time. Conservatorship may be something that isn't that bad at the beginning when it's imposed when the individual is 18 or 19, but it's not something that's easy to reverse. Courts really, really don't like taking out someone out from under a conservatorship. Once it's in place. And so that person at 40 or 45 may be living independently, may be working at a job almost full time, but is still under conservatorship. We've worked with folks in this situation and found it very difficult to get them out from under the conservatorship. Okay. So again, from the parent's perspective, this isn't just a problem in the long term. It's also a problem in terms of what is best for the individual. For the individual's perspective, it's a problem in terms of what's best for the individual. We all learn how to make decisions by making mistakes. We all learn how to make decisions by practicing making decisions. If someone is making the decisions for you, that skill is much harder to develop. It may not develop. And most studies that have looked at this show that folks who have that practice, who have been able to exercise decision-making and self-determination, are in fact better able to protect themselves from abuse or neglect. They know who to go to, they know who to ask, they know how to say no. So, let's talk for a few moments about supported decision-making. Does anyone want to try and define it for me? A brave soul? You wouldn't be wrong, because supported decision-making has so many definitions, right? It's a very broad category. What we like about it most at the ACLU is that it allows people with disabilities to retain their legal status, to retain their civil liberties. The idea is that an individual chooses one, two, sometimes three or more people who they trust to help them with the process of making decisions. Because it is a less restrictive alternative to conservatorship, under California law, we believe it should be tried before imposing a conservatorship. Okay, so a little more about supported decision making. The key piece of supported decision making is recognizing that we don't have an on-off switch with capacity. It's not all or nothing. People's ability to make decisions depend on the context, depend on the issue, depend on how they're doing at that moment in time. We all use supported decision making. I use it from everything from making major medical decisions to certainly what I'm going to do with my adolescent even whether I'm going to, you know, buy these dining room chairs versus those dining room chairs. The idea behind the more formal designation of supported decision making for people with disabilities is that the agreement is recognized, that both sides understand that for these areas of decision making, I'm going to go to these people for advice. There are formal documents that can be signed. We have examples of them on our website on the ACLU, which is at the end of your PowerPoint. But we also have more informal arrangements. The good thing about supported decision making is that you don't have to go to court. And as your relationships change, as your capacities change, as your opinions and interests change, you can change who is providing you the advice, who is providing you the support. So, some of the ways that we encourage people to think about providing support really breaks down into how decisions are made. Every decision has a goal, and that needs to be clear at the outset. And then identifying options, evaluating the pros and cons of those options, reminding the individual of what values they bring to the decision, and finally making the decision. Supporters should be willing to help with articulating any of those first four issues. What's the goal? What are the options, pros and cons? What are the values at play? But the idea is that the individual is the person who makes that fifth final step of what the final decision is. Supporters also may be really key in translating complicated ideas into plain language. One of the things that we did at the ACLU is translate powers of attorney into plain language. So powers of attorney for healthcare, powers of attorney for finances, permissions, so HIPAA releases translated into plain language, permission to work with the educational system once a child is 18, translated into plain language. So with these plain language documents, almost anything that you need legal authorization for, you can use and talk with an individual with a disability through if they want that support. And then finally, helping to communicate wishes to others. This may be because the individual has cerebral palsy and it is a skill that's developed to be able to understand what they're saying, or it may be because of a lot of what Rudy was talking about, in that you've spent enough time with the individual that you have a better guesswork system to be able to convey their values and wishes. So how do we know if supported decision-making might work for the patients that you see? The first step is to acknowledge that there's a wide range of issues, and we don't have a yes or no for each of them. And the second is to help them identify which areas they might need support in and who, help them find who they might use to provide that support. So one of the things that I'm glad we're doing pretty well with time, I want to spend a fair amount of time talking now about a new tool for competency evaluations. So those of you who've done competency evaluations, what do you usually use to do them? And I really do want you to speak up. Someone be brave. Okay. So you're talking about a competency evaluation for one particular decision, and you try and make sure that you understand that one decision. Okay. Great.
So that's the
great. Okay. Has anyone done competency evaluations for a conservatorship? So in California, guardianship applies to people under 18, youth, and conservatorship applies to people over 18, adults. And I'm talking about people over 18. In the rest of the country, guardianship generally applies to adults. It's confusing for those of us who work nationally, but okay.
That's the only kind of competency. If a parent asks for a conservatorship, they'll come to the regional center and ask for a letter, basically, say your opinion one way or another. But we don't usually do a whole evaluation.
Okay. That's really important. And we're going to come back to that. There's someone whose hand was up back here.
Oh, well, I use a medical model. I'm a nurse practitioner.
Okay. Their social situation, their past medical history, neurological exams, ability to communicate, IQ exams. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay. Thank you. So there's a good clarification that's happened here, that the term of art that you use is a competency evaluation is competency to stand trial, and conservatorship is a evaluation is a conservatorship evaluation. All right, then let me change my language, because I'm talking about a conservatorship evaluation. And the tools that I've usually seen and that the courts have usually requested are what you were saying of IQ exams, various short-term memory tests, problem-solving skills, et cetera. They're usually tools that are done in a relatively artificial context in an office. They're usually done without any support, even if the person generally does have support in their daily life. And they aren't done with what decisions an individual might actually make day to day. So from our perspective as lawyers, the ideal process would be spending real time from dawn to dusk with an individual, walking with them through their life, seeing at what points they act independently, at what points they act with support, and at other points someone else is intervening because they are unable to make a decision. That would be something that happens over a week or two. Obviously, the ideal approach is administratively and financially unfeasible. That's not something we can ask you to implement. Was there a question? I don't want to miss what you're saying. The folks who are in the overflow room and aren't going to be able to hear you. So I just want to try and summarize quickly. What you're saying is that usually in New Jersey, you're from New Jersey, you've got two people doing this, and you as the psychiatrist want to do the functional assessment. Quickly. And the hardest ones to do are broad-based, right? Okay. So let me just move on. I'm hoping that this is in your packet. There are two different forms. One is for a physician, and one is for an individual and supporters that are essentially checklists. This is a tool that the Missouri Center on Excellence and Disability began, and that we have modified and have been trying out. This is version 2.0. I expect we'll get to version 16.0 before we're satisfied with it. But I wanted to review it with you and ask for your help with this, because we want you guys to be the ones who are doing the evaluations for conservatorships. You are the ones who work with people who have developmental disabilities. You understand better what the capacities are, what the potential is, and you're going to be less likely to default to stereotypes about limitations and the need for a plenary conservatorship, and more likely to identify that there are many ways in which people who would otherwise be put under conservatorship could in fact use supported decision making. So So it's very hard to put a chart up on a PowerPoint, but I want to pull this out for you to highlight that there are not yes-no columns here. There are three columns. And on the left-hand side are the various areas. Thank you. It's in the book. Mm-hmm. Good. Various categories in which people may or may not need support. Various categories in which people may or may be able to act, may or may not be able to act independently. And one of the ways that we are hoping to expand and change the way these competency or conservatorship evaluations are done is to have an individual first fill this out for themselves with any available support, and talk through with whomever is supporting them which areas they are able to do by themselves. Maybe they're able to communicate very effectively, and maybe there is no problem with them being able to understand how they make choices. But this moves from communication to personal care to staying safe to home and friends, and breaks each of these areas down into small bits so that you can have a conversation with the individual about both whether they do this by themselves, whether they really don't do it at all, or whether they might be able to do it with support. And if they could do it with support, who that person might be. I'm going to just re-emphasize that this is a tool that we as attorneys want the courts to begin to pay attention to. This is a tool that we hope will develop some real life use to you and to us when we are working with people who may be put under conservatorship or may be eligible for supported decision making. It's also a tool that can just help in facilitating someone's independence. It's a way of seeing which skills might be able to be increased with support and learned over time. So I'm hoping that, and let me just give a couple more examples here. So for example, in transportation, it may be that someone who is going regularly to a job or to a friend's house or to a store has learned that skill, knows which bus to take, knows where their Clipper card is, and knows the route or even what to do if they miss their stop and need to go backwards. That would be a skill that is fully independent, right? There is no need for support. But if they have a doctor's appointment or a specialist appointment that they haven't been to before, it may be that that is something that they could figure out with support. Someone reminds them of the map and the route and talks about that with them beforehand. Or it may be that for that one instance, they need someone to go with them, or they need someone to order a taxi to take them back and forth. That's the kind of thing that as you work with an individual who has a disability, you can develop systems for and avoid the types of crises that often lead people to say, oh, this person needs a conservatorship. This person can't be living independently. And I'm going to reiterate that I recognize that folks here are prone to support independence. Thank you. They're prone to support supported decision making. Thank you. But just because that's your bent doesn't mean we don't want you doing conservatorship evaluations. When we have cases that are brought to us, the people who've done the conservatorship evaluations always find that this person needs to be under conservatorship. We need folks who can present counterbalancing evidence that there are ways in which this person can function and can at least try supported decision making before we condemn them to what is the greatest deprivation of civil liberties aside from the death penalty. Questions?
Talking about is the misuse of it and the abuse of it.
Thank you. Yeah. So let me, and we need to move to the next one and have some conversation afterwards, but I'm very glad you brought that up because you're absolutely right that the intent behind conservatorships and even the language of what direction the conservatorship is given is one of collaboration and one of representing the individual's interest. And that is absolutely what many, many conservators do for the ward. And I do not mean to impugn what really good, really helpful people are trying to do. At the same time, legally, if the individual disagrees with the conservator, there is no recourse. There's no recourse. Legally, that person is essentially at the whim and mercy of the conservator.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.